returned home exhausted, having sweated through my shirt and now loosened tie, and collapsed on my living room couch. Before drifting into sleep, I happened to check my email. I expected to read something about our next intern meeting. There were no work emails. Instead, there was one email labeled Harvard University, which made my heart skip a beat. 7 months ago, I had submitted my application to Harvard, and for 7 months, I heard nothing. They hadn't even shown me the common courtesy of a polite rejection letter. You know, the ones that say something like, "This year it was exceptionally difficult to choose an entering class because there were so many good candidates." And honestly, I had pretty much accepted my fate as one of the rejected. It had been so long that I had given up waiting for a response months ago. I had figured that someone in the Harvard admissions committee had pulled my application out of the pile, and with one quick look over, surmised that someone like me was just not quite good enough. "What gall for this young man to apply here," I imagined them saying. Then my application would have been passed around a great old table worn down by the weight of futures decided one way or another, just so the other committee members could have a good laugh before dispensing my application in the trash can. But my rejection letter never came. Lost in the mail, I thought. But now I was reading an email subject line, "Dean of Admissions, Harvard University." I sat back and stared at it for a long while, thinking of all the possibilities and dreading what it might say on the other end of that click. Could this be real? What could this be after so much time? It had to be the rejection, right? Nervously, I clicked through to the email. The Dean of Admissions at Harvard University wanted me to set up an interview date with a Harvard alum. Hey, Harvard had not rejected me. Well, they hadn't accepted me either, but I'll take what I can get from Harvard. They wanted more information from me, so this meant I still had a chance, no matter how slim. There are a few moments in everyone's life that are transformative and crucial. This was one. My mind started racing. Suddenly, my internship in Sacramento didn't seem so important. This email from Harvard had gotten me a shot at the plate, and now I needed to hit it out of the park. The university was kind to me in that Harvard had not requested additional essays. The writing for my application alone had taken me several weeks. I wouldn't have had enough time to write an essay that would land me a spot in Harvard. But I knew that I could seal the deal in person. People who have difficulty with reading and writing are often very personable. Place us in a cocktail party and we shine. I had spent my life trying to get people to laugh with me so they wouldn't be laughing at me, and I'm better at getting a date than getting a good grade on a standardized exam. So I did not fear my in-person interview. And that was probably worth at least half of my success. Nevertheless, I know I am most successful when I feel prepared. And for me, that was more about completing a process than reaching a threshold of information. The journey is what makes you successful. The destination is merely the culmination of a journey. In college, I had laborious routines for writing papers or studying for exams. My work was methodic and relentless, and that's how I knew I had to approach this next challenge. I had 2 weeks before the interview. My internship has got to go. So, my political career lasted one day. I had worked a long time just to get my foot in that Capitol building door, but I know an opportunity when I see one. I would rather risk it, follow the greater option, and lose them both than keep the one I already have. I refuse to keep the bird in hand. I'm headed for that bush full of birds. Harvard became the sole object of my attention. Once a thought gets in my head, it becomes my principal thought. My wife gives me a hard time about this sometimes. I tell her she can think of 10 things at the same time, whereas I think of 1 thing in 10 different ways. So my thoughts are never whole, but instead they are like moving puzzles I assemble in my mind. This can cause people who think like I do to tune out the rest of the world, much to the frustration of our loved ones and friends. Sometimes my wife has to say, "John, John," to get me to snap out of a thought. I have also discovered that the wail of a newborn baby girl is quite effective at breaking my focus. Having a heightened focus is an asset, but it can also be frustrating when that focus is interrupted by all the other tasks of one's daily life. I knew that paring down my schedule would help me immensely, because what I needed most of all was the time to think. And when you consider how busy we are, time is a great luxury. The next morning, my roommates trudged out to their own summer internships, and I walked to a coffee shop. I do some of my best work in coffee shops. In fact, I wrote much of this book in a coffee shop. Something about a hot cup of black coffee in a paper cup gets my mind firing. I had a good feeling those 2 weeks before my interview. I'm going to get this. This is mine. I don't know if I'm really confident or just really foolish. That's a fine line. I remember someone told me that Harvard rejects something like 1,400 valedictorians each year. I can't even say the word valedictorian. Yet I felt that Harvard was mine for the taking. Not in an arrogant way, but in the way a baseball player must feel when there are two outs and it's full count just before the pitch. A sort of nervous, excited confidence that fills you with adrenaline, that was me. It was still a hot summer in Sacramento, but I sipped my hot coffee and flipped the soft white pages of a book. I read a lot, sustaining myself on coffee and the occasional sandwich from a nearby deli. I had only a few days before my interview, and I was going to use every minute of it. I was reading two books at the time. One was about Lincoln, a man who kept failing throughout his life but never gave up. Another was about General Patton, who believed soldiers should not dig in once they had gained ground, but instead continue advancing on the enemy. These two men, separated by an ocean of time and circumstance, inspired me in equal measure. I had failed, but was not willing to give up. I had gained some success in life, but I needed to keep advancing. I was inspired, and now needed only to contemplate the Harvard interview as though it were a puzzle in my mind. But when you think in pictures, you encounter a recurring problem. How do you think about something for which you have no picture? I could not envision myself at the interview because I had never had a college interview before. I had been to job interviews, but this was different. This was the only part of the experience that made me uneasy. I remember reading that sometimes you look at your reflection in a pane of glass or a mirror just to make sure you are really there. I was going to be there, but I didn't know what there was. I was going to an unfamiliar part of town, to a home I had never visited, to meet a man I didn't know, to answer questions unknown to me. Somehow, I came to the conclusion that I had to be able to answer this one question. Why did I want Harvard? I imagined this was a question every interviewee had to answer. I then imagined the different possible answers a person might give. Some people would say they deserve to be at Harvard because of everything they've ever done in their life. Others, if honest, would say they wanted Harvard for the prestige. And some would answer by essentially begging to get in. None of these answers seemed very good to me. I remember writing in my notebook, "Please, please, let me in," then furiously scratching it out, thinking, "No, that is all wrong. I shouldn't answer the why question by trying to convince them to let me in," which is counterintuitive, right? I decided I only needed to tell Harvard what I wanted from it, and have them decide if they wanted to give it to me. This was the best strategy, a straight offer, a possible acceptance. I was ready. The man interviewing me had attended Harvard as an undergraduate and graduate student in the Harvard Divinity School before coming to Berkeley to study law. I had learned his name in an email in which he introduced himself and shared the address at which the interview would happen. Now that I knew his name, I did what anyone these days does. I Googled him. I learned that he worked as a legal counsel to the University of California Board of Regents. He was basically a lawyer for all of the University of California campuses. I had no doubt he was brilliant, and I wondered what questions he would ask me. Researching the man didn't give me much information, but it did help me imagine what sort of person he was, and thus picture him, which helped me since I'm a visual thinker. I awoke the day of my interview and felt a rush of excitement. Today was my day. I had not slept much the night before because of the anticipation, so I got up early, as I normally do. I brushed my teeth for several minutes as I paced back and forth in the tiny bathroom of my apartment. I was clean-shaven and wearing a freshly pressed navy suit and red tie as I headed out the door. It would take roughly 2 hours for me to get from Sacramento to the Oakland Hills where my interviewer lived. You could see my nervousness in the knot of my tie. I couldn't seem to get it right. Too tight, too loose, lopsided. Frustrated, I just let the tie hang loose as I drove. Driving through the mountain valleys on Highway 80, I felt like each minute was drawing me closer to changing my life one way or another. I arrived at the top of a hill overlooking San Francisco in the distance. I pulled to the side of the road and looked up a pathway that led to a beautiful multi-level white home with manicured lawns. There was an empty parking space in the front, but I decided to park down the street in case someone from his home needed that space. I stepped out of my car and the sun warmed my face for a moment. I straightened out my tie and jacket in my car window and walked up the street. As I stepped onto the path leading up to the house, I thought, this is it. I rang the doorbell and waited. A gray-haired gentleman in his 50s answered the door and greeted me with a big smile. My nerves disappeared as soon as I met him. I felt as though I had scored a point already just because we had a friendly introduction. He asked me to come inside, and I walked through a foyer and into a sitting room that was bordered by four large picture windows that opened up to a tremendous view of the city below and the Golden Gate Bridge. Before I sat down, I said, "Wow, I would love to wake up to this view every morning." He smiled and began to talk at length about what he loved about that view, though he lamented that a great tree across the way had grown over the years and now obstructed a part of it. I said I would talk to the mayor about having the tree moved, and this made him laugh. He directed me to sit on a couch in his living room as he retrieved a notepad and pen. As I waited, I looked around the room to get a feel for the man. African masks were displayed on a bookcase. I thought perhaps they were Kenyan, and because I had been to Africa a few times when I worked overseas, I thought this might be a good place to start. A few moments later, he returned and sat across from me on the couch. I pointed at the African masks on his bookshelf and asked him if he had visited Kenya. He said he went on safari in Kenya, and I could tell by his facial expression that he had loved that trip. Picking up on facial cues is a strength that visual thinkers often have, and a skill that can be useful at times like this. Not wanting to lose the moment, I asked him whether he had visited the nearby Seychelles Islands, which I had visited years ago. This led to a brief conversation about travels through Africa, and I felt as though I had established a good starting ground for our conversation about Harvard, though I was sure the interview was already underway. He then said, "So, tell me about yourself." I had not expected such an open question. I touched on where I grew up and the different things I had done in my life. Then I started doing what I know I can do well. I started sharing stories about ice sculpting, traveling around the world, becoming a teacher, and going back to school. This was the story of my life. While speaking, I was reading my interviewer's reactions, and I could gauge what he found most interesting. For instance, his posture and eyes became more engaged when I shared stories about my time ice sculpting and competing in a team. His interest diminished when I spoke about my travels in general terms, but I was able to capture it once again when I shared specific stories about my experiences in other countries. From this, I gathered he was a man who wanted to know the specifics. "It does make sense," I thought in the back of my mind. "The man is a lawyer." However, I did have a moment where I was thrown off balance. My interviewer had listened without comment until I started talking about my father, who grew up in the Bronx. I said he had fled New York as soon as he graduated high school. He asked, "Did your father have to leave New York?" with an intonation that made me realize I had insinuated something unsavory about my father by using the word fled. I mean, who flees? A person doesn't flee for good reasons. I immediately clarified that my dad hated living in a big city, loved country music and cowboy hats, and that this was the reason he moved out west. He nodded, and I relaxed. This brief interaction also suggested to me that moment that the man valued strong family character. Our conversation shifted to talking about Berkeley, where I was currently a student, and where he had attended for law school. I told him about my favorite place on campus, a bench next to the campanile that faces a bust of Abraham Lincoln. I told him I loved it because the statue was weathered by time and rain, and it was a good place to sit and think. My interviewer knew the school, knew the spot I was talking about, and began sharing his favorite place. At this point, the interview became more of a conversation, and I could tell we had reached a point in the conversation where it became clear we shared a love of something. Berkeley. I found it funny that in this interview about Harvard, we talked so much about how much we loved Berkeley. But then it came. The why question. Why Harvard and not another college? I was so glad I had thought about this. I said I wanted to be a student in economics and politics classes that were offered only at Harvard. I mentioned one professor in particular who had written a book about global politics and a clash of cultures. I think it was a gusty thing to do in an interview, but I said I disagreed with the professor's hypothesis and that I would love the opportunity to raise my objection in class. My interviewer said nothing. As I got up to leave that evening, I was uncertain if I had done well, but I knew I had put forward my best. I had swung with all my might. I thanked my interviewer at the door and headed down the street. I wondered whether I had talked too much. It was supposed to be a brief interview, but it lasted almost an hour and a half. I got in my car and sunk into the seat. I drove a while before pulling into a gas station and dashing into the restroom. At the sink, I looked into a dusty mirror and splashed cold water on my face. I had done it. I had made it through my Harvard interview. I felt good. On my drive back to Sacramento, I reviewed the conversation in my head. My mind then began thinking about the thank you note that is customary after an interview. I planned the note in my head. It was all I could think about, and I wanted to send it immediately, so much that I pulled into a copy store in Sacramento. I couldn't wait until getting home because I couldn't risk forgetting the words. This was a few years before smartphones, so I typed my note on a computer in the brightly lit store. In my email, I thanked him for seeing me on such short notice. I also wanted him to know that I had recalled our interaction carefully, so I said I would look into removing the tree that obstructed part of his view and a polite word of farewell and my name. The weeks following my interview were long and difficult as I waited for a response from Harvard. I was constantly checking my email, refreshing it dozens of times a day, hoping to find a reply from the admissions office. As the weeks passed, I got less and less hopeful each time I checked my email. I knew from my past experiences that a quick response was usually good news, and delayed response was usually bad news. My spirits sank as the weeks passed, and I slipped into sullenness. I had heard nothing from Harvard. I figured that they had decided against me, and this made me recall the interview as best I could, and then wonder how exactly the interview was weighed alongside my application. Perhaps one had been weaker than the other. By the first week of August, I had given up altogether and registered for my next semester of classes at UC Berkeley. I was disappointed, but thought Harvard had been very nice and fair with me through the whole process. I was edging toward being at peace with the outcome. Welcome week for the fall semester at Berkeley would start in a couple of days, and by now I had given up all hope of being admitted to Harvard. And honestly, the whole experience was now out of my mind. It was Friday morning, and I was wandering around Lower Sproul Plaza with a fresh cup of coffee in hand and a book bag hanging from my shoulder. I walked into the Student Learning Center to check my email and do some reading for my classes that were starting soon. I liked the computers in the Learning Center because, unlike the other computer labs on campus, you could drink coffee there, eat, work, all at the same time. There were few people in the Student Center at the time, and most of the chairs by the computers were empty. I sat at the first computer by the door. I always like computers at the end of the aisle, and I also like aisle seats on airplanes. Sitting back on a wooden chair, I logged on and started browsing an online news feed. After a few sips of coffee and a few not-so-interesting stories, I logged on to my email. Scanning down the subject lines on my email, I stopped at one very unusual email subject line. The subject line read, Harvard Student ID Number 906. It didn't make sense to me, and I sat back in my chair in disbelief. I read the screen again. Harvard Student ID. Was this one of those spam emails? After a few more moments of looking at the screen, I thought, what the hell? I clicked on the message. I was shocked to see that the email looked legitimate. It was telling me to click a link and enter my Harvard ID number. I did this, and the login worked. The whole screen lit up, and web things started happening, and it took me to my student page for fall. I had my own student page at Harvard? Now I was out of my seat at the computer lab, sitting back down, rising again, sitting back down. I felt ready to call everyone I know and let them know that I had been accepted to Harvard. But I was still skeptical. Could it be a mistake? I had to be sure, so I called Harvard admissions to check on my status. Ring, ring, ring. A friendly voice answered my call, listened to my question, and put me on hold. It felt like forever. She came back on the line and cheerfully informed me that it was no mistake, and that I was registered as a student at Harvard for the fall. Thank you, I said automatically, and hung up. Now wait a second. A Harvard admissions counselor had just said that I was a Harvard student. I almost fell off my chair. Then I told all the people around me in the lab that I had just been accepted to Harvard, and even though I didn't know them, they were excited and congratulated me. Hey, that guy just found out he got into Harvard, someone said. I ran out of the building and into one of my friends. She said, wow, that's great, and hugged me. I called my parents to share the news. What? I heard on the other end of the line. I didn't have much time to explain. The Harvard academic calendar was beginning soon. I dropped my classes at Berkeley, withdrew from Berkeley, sold my car, bought a plane ticket, and packed up all my belongings. I was moving to Cambridge to start classes at Harvard University. Chapter 9. Walking into Harvard. The night before my first day, I couldn't sleep. Although the trees were still green the day I arrived in Cambridge, the night was cold, and I could see the dimly illuminated courtyard outside my window as I tossed and turned in bed. Cabot House, where I was now living, was quiet that night, and I wondered whether my peers were having restless nights too. My room was on the fourth floor, and measured about 12 feet in either direction, and was appointed with a single wood bed, an oak desk, wood chair, a tall lamp, and an antique-looking hot water heater. I lay in my room thinking about my journey here, how unbelievable it was that I was here, and what the future might hold. Part of me wondered whether Harvard had made a mistake in admitting me. Amidst these thoughts, I eventually fell asleep. My alarm went off at 7 a.m., and I pulled on a pair of khakis, a navy sweater, and my brown leather shoes. I grabbed my leather messenger bag and headed toward the main campus. The morning was bright and crisp. My heart was pounding so loud I wondered whether other students could tell I was flustered. The Harvard shuttle bus approached Cabot House for the short ride to the campus. As the shuttle wound its way through the narrow Cambridge streets, my nerves were growing. Did I really belong here? After all, this was one of the finest universities in the world. Would someone like me survive this place? As the shuttle drew closer to the main campus, the driver slowed and pulled off to the side along Massachusetts Avenue. "Harvard Square!" he yelled as he opened the doors. This is it, I thought to myself, so many years leading to this single moment. I had to consciously tell my body to rise and my feet to move, all the while trying to look as natural as possible. I smiled at the people sitting across from me before making my way to the door. I thanked the driver and emerged in the cool New England morning. A young brunette girl in front of me was the first to leave the shuttle, and I watched as she turned towards the campus, walking swiftly and with purpose on the red bricks that line the sidewalks of Massachusetts Ave. She stumbled on a patch of uneven bricks protruding from the sidewalk, losing her balance for a moment before quickly regaining it. I was relieved to see her regain her footing, because I knew what it felt like to feel embarrassed about walking funny. Perhaps it was our collective nerves, but that first girl started some kind of chain reaction, because another young woman not far behind her stumbled, and then a young man right behind her. In that instant, my nerves melted and a smile formed on my face. People here were awkward, maybe just as awkward as I felt. A quiet confidence overtook me as I crossed the street and neared the ornately detailed iron gate that would lead me into Harvard Yard and my first day as an official Harvard student. The campus is resplendent with trees and colonial brick buildings. Walking through Harvard, one feels as though you have been transported to another time. The whole place echoes history. I learned that George Washington's soldiers had called my dormitory, Cabot House, their home for some time, too. The lecture halls and grand libraries, recalled the early American commitment to intellectual excellence. Distinguished professors and young, bright minds populated the school. It was also marked by an air of unspoken elitism. Unspoken, that is, until the graduate student instructor in my Intro to Political Thought class said to us, "You are the chosen ones to lead the world." I thought this was a bit much. I felt everyone treated us as though we were already leaders, even though I was just trying to get my bearings. Nevertheless, I could not hide how excited I was to be there. During the first week of classes at Harvard, a student can sit in on any class for the week before deciding a class schedule. I had rounded out my schedule with government, economics, and philosophy classes, the sort of classes I thought of as being quintessentially Harvard. I spent the rest of the day exploring the places to which my freshly printed Harvard ID card granted me access. I came home after my first day of classes, exhausted as I climbed the stairs to the fourth floor carrying a bag full of new books to my room. I sat in the wooden chair next to my desk, and my mind raced with the events of the day. I had just finished my first day of classes as a Harvard student. I looked out onto the manicured lawn below and the prominent buildings that framed the quadrangle. Suddenly, I felt a shortness of breath. I started breathing faster and faster as a wave of emotion took over my body. Tears welled up in my eyes for a moment before they started pouring out of me. I could not stop it. At first, I was frightened and imagined the headline in the Harvard Crimson paper, "In over his head student dies after first day of classes." I was overwhelmed with all sorts of feelings, contemplating the pain of my path here and the exuberant joy of making it. I felt as though my body was releasing all the stress and self-doubt that had built up inside of me over all those years. All the feelings of not being good enough or smart enough, being constantly reminded of my failures, and for some time believing I was a failure, all those feelings were being purged. Afterward, I felt an overwhelming sense of peace. I felt free, much like that day many years ago when I could finally run without the weight of my special corrective shoes. After this episode, I realized something about myself. I was a smart student who was among other smart students. I recalled all those who doubted my academic abilities, and in that moment I knew, for a fact, that they had been wrong all along. Every one of them. I just sat there at my desk in my room, and I felt grateful for the day and for this personal revelation. I was also glad that none of my fellow housemates witnessed this. How would I explain it? Oh, here comes that guy who wept that first day. That was just the first day. The second day, I felt like a different man. I had no doubts in my mind about my intelligence as I pulled on my coat in the brisk New England air and walked toward my political thought class. I knew it was incredibly unlikely that a guy like me would end up at a place like this. All my life, I had been doing what I was not supposed to be doing, and ironically, that's precisely how I ended up at Harvard. Afterword. If I had listened to the people who told me there were things I couldn't or shouldn't do, my life would have been entirely different. I would have forced myself to graduate high school, kept the safest job possible, stayed close to home, never gone to college, never would have met my wife, never would have written this book. I mean, it is a little bit funny that a guy who has trouble reading would decide to write a book. But like all other worthy endeavors in life, just because something seems impossible is no reason not to do it. When it comes to writing, I'm no natural. Words on paper see me coming and tremble in anticipation of misspellings, split infinitives, and other forms of literary malaise. I couldn't have done it without a lot of time, endless post-it notes, my computer's autocorrect function, handwritten drafts that I painstakingly transcribed during evenings, and the patience of my wife, who always answered me when I asked her, "Is it T-O-O or T-O right here?" It was usually T-O. Most people think Harvard is an impossible dream that is beyond the reach of average people. The myth goes that if you were at Harvard, you must have been at the top of your class, or you were one of the rich and powerful. I was neither. I approached my decision to go to college with a sense of purpose, wonder, and relentlessness. I didn't stop when teachers or parents dissuaded me from thinking big. I didn't want to do what other people wanted me to do. I didn't want to be like everyone else, and I wasn't. My brain was different, thought different. At Harvard, I found the same creative possibilities that define my earliest memories of education. Harvard is like kindergarten for smart, creative, ambitious adults. That's what made it so special to me. I am confident that at this moment there are talented people all over the world who choose not to pursue a big dream. Because they doubt themselves. Because they fear failure. Because they listen to the voice that says, you are not good enough. I might have become numb to failure after having failed so much in my early life. The threat of failure does not faze me. It prepared me for the world. You could walk up to the most beautiful woman in the room and get shot down. You are basically in the same position as if you had never walked up in the first place. Except you are not. Failure teaches us things that we can continue to apply in our life. And sometimes you try, and life surprises you by giving you everything you ever wanted. Because I had amassed so many credits in community college and that first semester at Berkeley, I was informed that I could only be a student at Harvard for 1 year and that I would have to return to Berkeley to finish my degree. I knew this going into Harvard, but it was still an opportunity I could not pass up. I relished every moment, class, book, professor, and friend I met there. I consider the education I received at Harvard to be one of my greatest accomplishments, and it continues to influence me personally and professionally. After Harvard, I went to Carnegie Mellon University on a public policy fellowship to continue my studies and experience in politics. Then it was back to Berkeley. But my story didn't end there. Not long after I returned to Berkeley, I met a woman and fell in love with her. We were both students in a small research seminar and sat at opposite ends of a big square table. One of the best strategies I developed for keeping up with copious amounts of reading was to create a summary of our class readings compiled by my fellow students. I emailed the class asking each person to submit a summary for a portion of the reading and proposed that I would email out the entire compilation. It helped everyone, but helped me especially. Everyone in the class responded to me, except for one woman who saw through my self-interested plan. We happened to be placed in the same group for a final project. And some weeks later, our group of three went on a research assignment to San Francisco, which ended prematurely when our other partner decided she had to go back to catch up on some work since finals were fast approaching. We were left together on Pier 39 by the barking sea lions. We got on a trolley to head back to the train that would take us back to Berkeley, when she happened to ask, "Have you ever been to the Museum of Modern Art?" "No," I said. At that moment, she pulled the wire that ran alongside the wall of the trolley, which made it stop just in time. We got out and walked 2 blocks to the museum, where we spent the afternoon. When we left, it had grown chilly, so we ducked into a nearby cafe called Citizen Cupcake, which sat atop the Virgin Music Store. Thank you, fellow dyslexic Richard Branson. I drank a cup of black coffee, and she sipped a hot chocolate from a cup that looked like a bowl. Her brown waves of hair swayed lightly, and her eyes widened whenever she talked about a subject she loved. I asked if she would like to grab dinner, so we walked a few more blocks to a small restaurant where I talked to her about my travels, and she talked to me about her favorite books. When we finally started back home, evening had turned into the early night, and I tried to kiss her, but she put her arm up to my chest and said, "I like you as a friend." 6 years later, we were married. I'm a visual thinker who fell in love with a linear thinker. Sometimes we laugh together about the prospect of me being unable to read the book I wrote. One day, my wife said to me that she wished she could understand the world as I do. If only she could be dyslexic for a day. How does a person experience visual thinking? It's hard for linear thinkers to grasp. There are some dyslexic simulations that mimic the dyslexic perspective. These can help show non-dyslexics the challenges faced in completing even simple tasks. In that instance, you may understand dyslexic frustration. But what the simulations fail to convey is the complexity and beauty of visual thinking. The visual thinker makes connections all the time and sees details others often miss. I think that visual thinking and visionary thinking are cut from the same cloth. It's hard to explain. Visionary people are often told their ideas are impossible, ridiculous, and wrong. but these people are visionaries precisely because they can see what everyone else fails to see. Visual thinking engages meaning in an extraordinary way. I experience the world as a rush of connections, images, and information that I understand three-dimensionally. I approach problems as though I were assembling a picture in my mind. I make an idea into a three-dimensional thing, spin it, invert it, break it apart, put it back together again, and inspect the details. Sometimes, if you can pin down a problem from an unexpected angle, you find an unforeseen solution. That's when my mind is solutions-oriented. Sometimes my mind runs unbridled. Daydreaming and imagining is a key to new knowledge. I can sit for hours thinking and visualizing. Sometimes a thought may take over my brain for months. When I met my wife, she was all I could think about. I had to seclude myself in campus cafes if I wanted to get any work done. Even now, if she walks into the room, I can focus on nothing else. Over the years, I've amassed countless images and moments of her in my mind. If my mind is a world unto itself, she is my starry sky. As this book goes to print, my wife and I have welcomed a baby daughter into our family. She marks the next great adventure of my life. This has been High School Dropout to Harvard, My Life with Dyslexia. Written by John D. Rodriguez. Narrated by Morgan Ingram. Copyright 2012 by John Rodriguez. Production copyright 2017 by John Rodriguez.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.